Welcome to the season finale of Bakeology. I'm your host, Adam Miller, and I'm joined this week by comedian Suranjay Amana, and together we're going to explore how food shapes who we are with a no soggy bottom guarantee. Suren has found time to sit down with me between the Sydney and Melbourne comedy festivals to talk all things food. Suren is no stranger to exploring the stories behind the foods people love, having hosted Good Tucker, which is a six-part series on SBS here in Australia, exploring multicultural cuisine in regional Victoria. In this episode, Suren and I explore almost as many themes as there are items on a dumpling house menu, from multiculturalism to flavour enhancers, from how food brings people together in times of crisis to how the memories of loved ones who have passed live on through their favourite foods. Suren even, very bravely I might add, declares which Australian capital city is his favourite foodie destination. So if you ordered a serve of captivating conversation with a healthy dash of chuckles and spice, this next hour is guaranteed to satisfy. Suren, thank you so much for being on Bakeology. I'm so excited to have you on.
No worries. It's a real treat, I think, to be talking about treats for the next hour. I'm excited.
Before we get into the food, I just wanted to talk about your CV. It's quite diverse. It includes comedian, writer, actor, budding home cook, and a qualified but not practicing tax accountant.
Yes, that's right.
Which of these has been the most useful in your life so far?
I guess comedy has been the most fruitful. It's the passion, and it's the thing that's kind of led me to the most interesting, like a lot of those doors have opened because of comedy, I guess. I think it would even be why I'm on this podcast today. but I'd have to say every sort of June, July, the tax, it definitely comes in handy. Yeah. I know for a fact that a lot of people come tax time have this irrational fear that they're going to end up in prison.
Yes.
And I a lot of my tax knowledge has fallen away since I've left accounting, but I at least know I'm not going to end up in prison, which I think is handy to have. Yeah.
It is handy. Do you do your own taxes or do you pay someone else?
No, I do my own. I mean, embarrassingly so, my comedy career is not at the level yet where I require like someone to come in with complex structures and trusts and all of that. But hopefully one day I'll have to get in help. Yeah, that's a good goal.
It's good to have goals.
It is.
Speaking of your comedy, you've recently performed at the Adelaide Fringe and the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and you have Sydney and Brisbane coming up. What's your show about this year?
So this year I'm doing a split bill show with a fellow comedian called Matt Stewart, who podcast listeners might know. He's got some great podcasts called Do Go On and Who Knew It with Matt Stewart. Mm-hmm. And it is a departure from the traditional thing, which is both of us would do our own solo shows. But we've kind of, I feel like every year coming up with a brand new solo show is a fun challenge, but as we've both got a bit busier with different projects, we're going to have a bit of fun and just sort of like start the process towards next year's full 60-minute show with just kind of a bit of a muck around. Adelaide was so much fun. We split the hour between us. We have a bit of banter up the top and at the end.
Yep.
And it's a nice little fun. The thing that's fun for an audience is you get to come in and see two professional comedians kind of on the start of the journey. Which I think,
that's a rare thing to see, I would have thought.
I think so. And we're charging full price for that, but you...
well, it's two for one, right?
So exactly, I think it balances out. Exactly, yeah. But it's you're in safe hands. I think Adelaide went really well and very excited to... Well, Melbourne went well as well and very excited to get to Sydney and Brisbane soon.
Yeah, so good. I want to chat about your previous show, which you did perform in Adelaide this year, I believe. Now, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right. A bag full of Vegeta?
Yeah, the bag of Vegeta.
Vegeta?
Although I have been, I think some people say Vegeta, some people say Vegeta.
Yes. Well, my first question was, have I pronounced that correctly?
Yeah, okay.
The answer was no. So tell me your thoughts on flavor enhancers.
I love it. I love Vegeta so much. The show, the title there was like a kind of wordplay on the Bhagavad Gita, which is like a Hindu text. Hmm. A spiritual book, and I found some parallels, I guess, in MSG and the message of God, I guess. But it was sort of like, yeah, I went into a deep dive in Hinduism through COVID, kind of, because my mum's background, like that side of the family, is Hindu. Yeah. And then I also went into a deep dive in food through COVID. And so the show kind of revolved around those two things. But Vegetta, to answer your question, my position on flavor enhancers is Vegetta makes everything better.
I agree. Yeah. And it rhymes.
And
it,
yeah, exactly.
You can't get past that.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I used to avoid MSG because I thought it was one of the things.
It has a really bad rap.
It does. And people talk about migraines. I never had that, but I did used to think it contributed to my eczema.
Mm.
And then one day I was just like, I don't know. I just made that up in my head. I don't know where that came from. And I
bought into the hysteria.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Some hype. I was bringing some unconscious bias against flavor enhancers, but now I use it so much and it's good stuff.
It is good. I feel like MSG might've had a little bit of a return.
Yes.
Like it's not frowned upon. Renaissance, that's a much better way to put
it. I should say, by the way, that Vegetta is not just MSG. There's other stuff in there, but the MSG's doing the heavy lifting. We can all agree, yeah.
It is. The vegetables that are in there, they're just there for show.
Yes, exactly.
You get that little bit of dehydrated carrot to prove that there's something there.
Bit of dehydrated celery. It's good stuff.
Mm, it's all good. It all tastes delicious. So your comedy career, you get to travel around to a lot of capital cities, which means you get to try the best food potentially that the cities have to offer. Is there a city you've toured that has stolen your stomach?
Whoa. I assume stolen your stomach, you mean like stolen my heart.
Stolen your heart.
Yeah. I love that. That's a nice little play on words. I reckon I'm yet to go to Africola in Adelaide. Every time I always forget.
That book looks amazing.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if it was from the book or just... Maybe he was on Adam Liao's show or something like that.
Yes.
But we cooked the like peri peri chicken out of his.
Oh, when you were on there as well.
Just at home. My partner and I found his recipe and we made it. And it was so good. She made the peri peri, like the hot sauce. It was like we had to brine the chicken and then the hot sauce was like a 2-day process, but it was good.
So it was a homemade hot sauce.
Yeah. So I would definitely love to go to Africola, but that said, having missed out on Adelaide's best restaurant, Adelaide still is the city that's stolen my stomach because it is a great food and wine town. Mm. And
Queen Maggie lives there.
Queen Maggie lives there. I've not been to the Barossa yet, but we went up to Harndorf, which is like in the Adelaide Hills and it's like a German town.
Hmm.
And it's a bit quaint and a bit odd because they've sort of constructed, it's not like an organically, this just a lot of Germans that sort of built this town.
Yes.
It's like there were a lot of Germans and they're like, why don't we make like a tinsel town kind of thing? But you can go there, you can get a giant pork knuckle and like brew.
So good.
Yeah. And then, there's also a great Chinatown in Adelaide. So to me so far, Adelaide has been the city that's punching above its weight.
Mm. I've not been to Adelaide, so I'm very sad to say.
It's very fun. Yeah. And I think, I mean, a lot of people, I usually go during the fringe and a lot of people are like Adelaide in fringe.
Like it lights up?
Yes. Yeah. And they're like Adelaide the rest of the year is, there's nothing going on. But I think maybe with the food scene and maybe with the migration that's happening, I think that's changing.
Let's go regional now.
Okay.
And talk about your show, Good Tucker.
Yes.
It's on SBS. On SBS On Demand, I believe. It's where I've been watching it, which is all about exploring multiculturalism through food. Tell me more about the concept and why you wanted to create it.
Essentially, I've always been obsessed with like because I do a lot of driving for comedy as well to regional towns. And I've always been obsessed with like the one Chinese restaurant or the one Indian restaurant in a country town. And, I have a real vivid memory of going to like Stanthorpe in Queensland, a couple of hours out of Brisbane.
Yep.
My partner's got relatives who have a farm there and we were driving there and went out to dinner at this Indian restaurant. And I remember looking at like the staff in the restaurant and sort of seeing these parallels between myself and them. But like I grew up in a city, they were like, children of Indian immigrants.
Yeah.
I grew up to Sri Lankan parents, but like, being born in a city, I could go be an accountant and then do comedy at night and then sort of make the decision to pivot at one point. But I was just like, what is it like to grow up in Stanthorpe and work here in this community that's like mostly kind of Anglo-Aussie and farmers and sort of like salt of the earth kind of people. And then you're this Indian family. And I was just fascinated by what the lives of those people are like. So that was the pitch for the show.
Yeah.
And then we made it through like Channel 31 originally, and then it came together really well. on a shoestring budget.
Yeah.
And so we went and took it to SBS and they were like, yeah, we'll give you not a lot of money for that. But but I'm so happy that it's there because, it was such a fun show to make, especially getting to towns and not knowing the story exactly that you're going to find, and then talking to people and realizing that, yeah, that nugget of an idea of like, what is it like for these people is there. It's actually, everyone has a story that's so interesting.
They
so you just have to trust you'll find it, and you kind of do. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you already have an idea of the restaurants that you wanted to go to, or did you just go to the town and sort of,
I did like a Google map search,
the best kind of search
of restaurants, and was sort of, the first round of looking for places was discriminating only through like, is this cuisine sound exotic or something like that for the location.
Yeah.
And then we sort of whittled it down, and you'd research from the restaurants to see what kind of legacy it had in the town as well. Cause one thing we wanted to do, which we didn't have enough time, I think, to really nail, but was to try to speak to locals who would go to the restaurant and see what it meant to them.
Yep.
We didn't quite get the time to capture that part of it, but like that was a motivator, was looking for restaurants that looked like they had a bit of a presence or that they'd left a mark on the town, and that, and see what that story was.
Yeah. Were there any stories that left a mark on you?
Yeah, a couple. The one, well, this is a great example of getting to a place and thinking we had the story, and then once we got there, finding it was when we went to Mallacoota, which is right on the far east coast of Victoria. There's one road into Mallacoota, there's one road out. It's the same road out. But a lot of people would remember the name because of the bushfires. Just before COVID.
All those people crammed on the beach.
That's it. Yeah. That's Mallacoota. And devastating. And so when we went there, we'd found this restaurant called Lucy's, and she was a Chinese migrant who had kind of in her 60s now. But she lived in China, and this Australian guy had gone over there and he was teaching English there, and they fell in love. And so she came out with him here.
Yeah.
And then, cut a long story short, she decided that she wanted to open up a like very authentic Chinese restaurant and like brought out a dumpling, like equipment to make noodles, authentic noodle making machine.
Yep.
And then she was hand making dumplings. And it was pretty incredible. People from China had heard about it, and these famous like Lucy's noodles. And so we thought that would be the story.
Mm.
We were like, we're going to go watch her make noodles with this machine that she's imported from old world China. And sort of, we thought, what is this Chinese restaurant that's so authentic doing on the far east coast of Victoria, in a town that most Victorians probably never even go to?
Yeah, and when you think of Chinese restaurants in regional Victoria, you generally think of
the sweet and sour pork and
lemon chicken that glows in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. So that we thought, well, that's an interesting story. We got there and it just so happened that we were traveling in winter, and because tourism's quite low in winter to coastal towns, she puts the noodle machine away for the winter.
Yeah, right.
And so she was just making the handmade dumplings. She's like, I'm a bit older now and it's a lot of effort to do the hand pulled noodles. So we're like, oh, well, it's not as interesting to just watch her make dumplings. I think we watched me badly attempt to make dumplings as well. But then through talking to her son, we uncovered this story that during the bushfires, Lucy's was like, so many people obviously were forced out of their homes, and because there's only one road into Mallacoota, they were cut off from a lot of supplies.
Yeah.
And so what ended up happening was like basically Lucy's got asked to step in and start cooking food for the rest of the town.
Oh, wow.
Because they had the equipment, they had the kitchen, and the they were getting a gas supply from the army, would bring it through the coastal route. Yeah, basically them and maybe one or two other restaurants were feeding this whole town of people who were disenfranchised and sort of.
Yeah, wow.
And that's
incredible.
And then as soon as we heard that, we were like, well, we got to go try chat to the fire chief and find out more about it. And it became about like Mallacoota as a town, its resilience through that hardship. So it was, it was a beautiful story.
Yeah. I guess it's the heart of the small country town, right?
Yes.
What I think makes those places special.
100%.
Having grown up in, not in a small town like that, but in regional Victoria, the people get behind each other.
It is. You could really feel it there. And I think that's spot on.
Yeah. Let's go back to Soren's childhood. And you unfortunately had a food allergy. So you missed out on a few foods growing up.
Yes.
Tell me about the food that young Soren could enjoy.
Yeah, that I could enjoy. Well, it was very not extensive. I was allergic to everything. I couldn't eat eggs, nuts, shellfish, and sesame with like the anaphylactic things.
Mm.
And then I also was allergic to dairy and like wheat because of it would give me eczema.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't particularly.
Did you grow up on carrots?
Yeah. A lot of rice. A lot of steamed rice. I think Sri Lankan, like mum's Sri Lankan ethnicity, born in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. So the cuisine's kind of like Malaysian, South Asian kind of style.
Yep.
And that fortunately is very rice based and spices were fine. So I didn't feel like I was missing out a lot, except for when I was like out with friends kind of thing. I remember one time being on school camp and a lot of school camp I'd just eat rice or just like a piece of meat. I could always, whenever we went out for lunch and stuff, I'd just end up ordering steak because it was like the safest thing at a restaurant to order. But like as a 6-year-old, your dad doesn't let you get medium rare or whatever. So it would just be like a burnt, well done, completely burnt to a crisp.
That's exactly how my dad loved it as well.
Yeah.
And whenever mum would cook steak at home, it would often be under, you know, those old style grills where you had the drawer.
Oh, yes.
And it would be cooked on there and I would just like love a little bit of red. And then it would always come out in Dad's preferred way.
Yeah. The red comes from the tomato sauce that you douse it in on top. Does. Yeah, that's So limited diet. I think at home I was well looked after and almost to the detriment of my elder brothers. Like the diet that I had became the diet for the whole family. Just because it was like a bubble boy situation otherwise.
I read that wheat-based foods came in quite late to sort of historical Sri Lankan diets.
Yeah. I don't know. That's interesting. I don't know too much about the history of it, but from experience in eating in Sri Lanka and like the food that we eat at home, even the breads and stuff, quote unquote, what you'd call breads, a lot of them are rice flour based or lentil based even rather than wheat based. I guess it makes total sense though that it would have been a more recent introduction. Mm.
I mean, I still think we're talking like hundreds of years.
Yeah. Yeah.
When did you discover you weren't allergic anymore?
So I was out to dinner with my partner. It was like very early on in our relationship. We've been together forever, but I think I was just trying to impress her. So she was a foodie and I hadn't yet really become much that into food. I liked food, but I was still like very much like whatever I can eat, I'll eat, but I'm not adventurous. But then she suggested this Middle Eastern restaurant. I was like, well, she's the foodie. I don't want to like veto this. Let's go along. And I'm sure I'll be able to find something. Not realizing that like if you have a sesame allergy, there's going to be traces in everything in the Middle Eastern cuisine. It is a lot of people think Asian is quite difficult with sesame, but like I've come to learn that sesame oil is quite expensive and a lot of Chinese restaurants won't actually use it. Whereas like Middle Eastern, tahini is like the purest form of sesame.
Yes, it is.
It's like you've just gathered up all of the sesame you can find.
Roasted it. Pureed it.
Yes.
Eat it.
Yeah. It's like, if you gave sesame seeds to like Walter White from Breaking Bad, he would come up with a product that's like as pure as tahini.
I love that.
But so we were at this restaurant and I did the usual thing. Every time I go out to eat, I stress that I have a sesame allergy and that it includes this and that. And they were like, yeah, that's okay. That's fine. But it just is inevitable that the tahini, it's in the baba ganoush, it's in the hummus, it's in everything, and it will definitely have touched everything.
Yes.
So very quickly I realized that I was like having a reaction.
Mm. Is this an EpiPen situation or?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a coward in that I don't, we were close to a hospital. So I was like, I say coward. It's also the EpiPens, like they come, you get one a year on the PBS or whatever. And then if you use that, the next one's like $400 or something.
Yeah. No, so I was
like,
that.
If you go to the hospital, like they'll just give it to you from their supply. But we're on like an early date. It wasn't the first date. I think when I talk about it on stage, I say it's the first date because it's good storytelling. But I think it was very early on in the courting process, and it was pretty insane to end up at the ER, but that's where we did. And the doctor was sort of just talking to me about my allergies, and it came out that I hadn't been tested since I was a kid. Mm. I just assumed that you're just always allergic to it.
Yeah.
And then he was like, you should go get tested.
Mm.
And I did. And the test results indicated that sesame was the only thing that I was still heavily allergic to. And I didn't trust it at first. Because it had been drummed into me since a kid.
Yeah.
And also I grew up in the 90s. I don't think allergies were that huge then.
No.
I was kind of the one guy I knew that had it. To the point where I was like, at school, they would have a picture of my face in the staff room.
It's like the do not serve.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I hadn't done anything wrong. But now I'm sure it's like, now they've just banned peanuts. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So yeah, I went and got tested, and what I ended up doing was finding an allergy specialist and then taking food in and he watched me eat it. And I don't think that was a new experience for me. I think for him as well, he was like, most people just trust the results of the test, but you guys seem extra paranoid. So we crushed up some peanut and he put it on my lip, and then he watched me for 20 minutes. And then he was like, I think, you're fine. From there, I slowly introduced peanuts, shellfish and eggs into my diet. And it changed,
was all fine.
Changed everything. Yeah.
It sounds like the concept for a new YouTube show. I think with the creepy doctor.
That is brilliant. I think,
he was a doctor, right?
That's a good question. Yeah.
This is a perfect segue into the first food you've chosen. We're talking hoppers. Hoppers or appam?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. For those who might not be familiar with them, how would you describe a hopper?
It's delicious. It's sort of like, I guess the best way to describe it is it's like a fermented pancake.
Mm.
So it's like coconutty, but because it's fermented, it also has a sourness. And what makes them particularly unique is the shape of the hopper or the appam, which is sort of bowl shaped, but it's this very delicate batter that's drizzled into like a small wok shaped pan, and you cook one at a time. So the batter that you pour into that becomes the hopper.
Yep.
And because of the wok shape, the heavier bit of the batter pulls around the bottom and forms like a little disc.
Yep.
And then around that, the film that's left of the batter like crisps up right around the edge of that wok shape.
It's almost like a crispy lace.
It's around. Yes. And so it's like a textural, it's like there's a lot going on there. And what is common to do, especially at breakfast, is that they'll crack an egg into the center of that pancake. So it's like you get the gooiness of the egg plus the fluffiness of the fermented coconut rice batter, and then also this lace of crispiness around the outside. Perfect for mopping up, sauces, curries, and getting a bit of textural crunch, but also this delicious batter flavor.
Yeah, and you don't see many of them around. I think my voice just broke as well there, but that's okay. Congratulations to me. Finally a teenager. I had my first one at the Lankin filling station in Sydney.
Oh, yes.
Blew my mind. You discovered them somewhere slightly more exotic.
Yeah, that's right. I've only been to Sri Lanka once in my life. And when we went as a family trip, kind of probably around 2012, I think it was, we did a pretty much tour of the whole island.
Wow.
And one of the places we went to is called Kundalama, which is this like 7-star hotel.
I Googled it. It's so impressive.
Yeah. It's like built into a cave pretty much. And it's like you're in your room, you'll look out and there's like, you can see the rock that the room is built into. And it's also iconic because it has a view of like Sigiriya, which is a mountain. I guess it's sort of similar to Uluru, I would say, in terms of like spiritual significance,
okay.
I think, in Sri Lanka. But at this, because it's a 7-star hotel, they have like the breakfast buffet is incredible.
Mm, I love a breakfast buffet.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's one of the highlights of life, I think.
I agree, particularly when you're traveling. Like, I won't have the buffet at the RSL, but if I'm overseas, because my partner Nick does all the booking, hotel is like, do we get breakfast included? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, why would you not?
Yeah, exactly. You have to do it. And if you don't do it, you have to go down there and just make up a room number or something, because they're so good. And this one was incredible. Especially, I love the ones in Asia where they'll have the, or maybe I've only ever stayed in them in Asia because they're more affordable.
Yes.
So this could be every hotel, like breakfast buffet, but they'll have like the continental, and then they'll have the hot European,
yes,
or hot English or whatever. But then they also have like fried rice.
Yes.
And they'll have like, yeah, curries or nasi lemak or whatever. Yeah. They have the whole gamut. It's a bit like Preston Market. And and yeah, this particular place, normally I'm a fan of the egg station where you can go there, you pick out, do you want your scrambled or your omelette or yeah, whatever. Yeah. But here they had the hopper station.
Yeah, I love this.
Yeah. And so as a man, he had, because you can only cook one at a time in, or like one per pan, yes, basically. But he had this burner of like 12 burners.
Wow.
And like, yeah, 12 little pans on there, and he was making them to order. And if you wanted it, he'd crack an egg in. You could get double egg hopper. and it was just amazing. That was the first time I tasted it. And that they serve it with pol sambal, which is like this Sri Lankan condiment, which is like coconut that's sort of freshly grated and then mixed with lime and chili and like onion, pepper, that kind of thing. And it's the sweetness of the coconut plus it's very just fresh tasting.
It's
and
quite spicy.
A bit spicy, yeah. And then they also serve it with sini sambal, which is like caramelized onions with like little flakes of, they call it moldy fish, but it's like dried, I think it's like dried tuna or something. But very, very tiny. They grind it up. And so it's like almost the way that like fried anchovies with that kind of salty fishiness mixed into this caramelized onion jam. Ooh. And it's like, I had never tasted that onion jam before either, sini sambal, and I still dreaming of going back to eat it.
I can see the love for it in your eyes as you describe it. Can you buy it?
It stole my stomach. It did. I've bought it in jars, but it's never the same. But you can, I mean, it is pretty much just like caramelizing onions and then, but mixing in some spices and this like salty fishiness.
So you've been trying to make them at home now. You bought the pan, which has a name, which I've forgotten.
So appam is the hoppers, and then the pan is called an upper chutty.
Upper chutty.
Yeah.
What's the key to a good hopper when you're doing it yourself?
The most important thing is the fermentation, because that's where the sourness kicks in and the lightness as well. That's what, the more fermented it is, the more like fluffy that little base
is. How long does the fermentation take?
If the weather is like warm and kind of moist, like tropical Sri Lanka, I think overnight is fine.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it is effort because you've got to remember that you want to do this, that you're going to make hoppers because it's breakfast. Like you've got to think about it the day before. Yeah.
Is the action of pouring it in, is that an easy thing?
It takes a bit of practice, I think, because you really want that layer that's around the rim of the chutty to be as crisp as possible. Mm-hmm. I think initially I was trying to pour it on the rim and let it fall in.
Yeah.
But I think that the technique that seems to work best is you get it all into the middle and then you sort of have to swirl it out from there. And it's similar to like how you'd see, I guess the Vietnamese have that, is it bun xiao or bun chon or something similar, but it's on a flat pan, but they kind of push it out.
Yes.
Or like crepes they do the same thing. With
The broom little, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't know.
The crepe broom, I don't know. Yeah.
So it's similar to that, but here it's like you don't have a device. It's just all in this swirl technique, which is pretty fun actually. Yeah.
Did it take you long to nail?
Yeah, and it is so much like pancakes in that the first one's always shit. Can you swear?
Swearing's permitted, yes.
Okay, yeah. So the first one's always like a rubbish one. That's for the chef. You just sort of nibble on that while you're doing the rest, but you warm up to it. It might even be the pan's not at the right temperature or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about pancakes. There's
always the first ones in the bin.
Yeah. Yes, in the bin. We're going to head to a meaningful feast now, which you have called your uncle's feast. There's a bit of a tradition around this. Do you want to tell us the story behind that?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, my mum's side of the family is Hindu. My brothers and I were raised Catholic because dad's Catholic, and so had very limited kind of exposure to Hinduism throughout my life. And not that long ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, my uncle, who's a mum's brother and lived in Malaysia, he fell sick. And I remember getting a call from mum, and like I haven't spent a whole lot of time with him because we lived in different countries, but he was like one of those, everyone has an uncle who's like, ever since you're young, there's just this mystique about them.
Yeah, and they leave the impression on you.
Yeah. And he said he was that guy for me.
Yeah.
And so when he fell sick, I immediately was like, yeah, I'll come. I'll jump on a plane and let's go. And unfortunately, he passed away while I was on the flight over. But what that meant is that I basically landed in the middle of this full-blown Hindu funeral situation, which if you have not had a whole lot of experience with Hinduism, to start with a funeral is a very surreal and
dialing it right up.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a whole lot of ritual and stuff involved with that. But the feast itself, and which was, I think, in the end, a really cool thing to do for someone who's just passed.
Yeah.
But it revolves around this idea basically that the soul, when it leaves the body, is sort of like you want to wish it well onto its next journey.
Yes.
And so a lot of the rituals leading up to this point were trying to actually prevent the soul from trying to get back into the body, which is what's in Hinduism. There's like not a fear, but there's like this belief that that is something that the soul might attempt to do. And so one of the rituals that are intended to help guide the soul onto its next journey is to basically everyone gathers around the whole family and prepares dishes that were that person's favorite dish
from
their life. Yeah. And so in South India and Malaysia and Sri Lanka, so particularly amongst the like South Indian, Sri Lankan communities in Malaysia, it's very common to have banana leaf as the base for a dish. So that's like, it's called banana leaf rice. You don't actually eat the banana leaf, but what it is like a bunch of rice in the middle of the banana leaf and then a whole bunch of curries and pickles
just
and
around it.
Dishes all around it. And then you drizzle it all with sauce. And so everyone, we discussed what Mama's favorite dishes were.
Yeah.
And then we all kind of divvied it up and everyone took turns to prepare their own thing.
Yeah.
Some of it was like going off to the shops as well, because it was like
takeaway.
Yeah, he really liked the fish from this place in this suburb. And so it was like a trek to go out and get, the fried fish from that place, get the fake meat chicken curry from this other veggie place. And then I think I cooked just like tempered potatoes, just like diced potatoes, pretty simple, but then with the spiced oil. Yes, so much food. It was very cathartic way as well to like cooking with all of your relatives who are going through this mourning process and spending basically a day and a half, I think we were all just cooking and then laying out the feast. And the first thing you do is lay out the feast, and we put a little bit of everything onto this banana leaf.
Yep.
And you give some of it to the priest as like an offering to the priest. And then you also leave some of it out on the, like in front of my auntie's place was just this like little park.
Yes.
And so we just left this food out on the park, and that's sort of like the offering to the soul.
Yes.
And then after that you just tuck in and everyone enjoys the fruits of their labor. But it was a very, very touching and beautiful kind of tribute to send off a life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. Is it just a single meal that you spend like a day or two preparing for, or is it like an all day?
It's pretty much
a couple of days type of thing.
I think it's very much like around the timing of all of these rituals falls into like ends up being quite structured, because you've got to sort of, the priest has to come for various different things. So it almost falls around like when the priest is, and it's all building up towards cremation and then building up to the point where you're then ready to scatter the remains, which is the final step of the whole process. But so it's like, I remember it being just, it was a day of everyone just cooking and like maybe then the next morning everyone going out to get the little takeaway things that he loved. and then it was the offerings and the feast. So
Does it feel like a celebration?
Totally. Yeah. and particularly because this comes after like a lot of the, there's days of prayers and there's, his body was in the casket in the house for a lot of the prayers as well. So there's days of proper actual heartfelt kind of pouring out of emotions. And then at the end of the whole funeral rites probably takes about a week,
I'd
say. And this comes towards the end of that week.
Yeah.
And it is in the way awake is all you've had the ceremony, and at the wake, it's like people letting their hair down and sharing stories.
Yes.
And it becomes about that celebration. The people who remain behind are starting to move on from the loss and like, well, now we're ready to kind of put ourselves out of the, you know, we've dealt with the grief we feel, and now let's celebrate the life that was.
Yeah. I love that. When my dad passed away about 5 or 6 years ago, I remember, I think it was either the day of or the day after, like, because family were staying in hotels near the hospital and I just lived around the corner, and we all got together that night. And I mean, it was nothing special. It was a room maybe this size. So a table of, you'd fit maybe 8 people. We made lasagna together. We made salad together. And I mean, it's a pretty standard sort of meal, and not necessarily one that Dad was known for, but in a similar way, I think just that act of cooking together, being together, it just takes the edge off what can be, well, or what is a really emotional and sad time.
And it gives you something to focus on and something to do, which I think helps ease the mind a bit. Because when you have something to focus on, you're not like wallowing too much or getting stuck into the negative. But you're in this thing with people as well. That's really beautiful. That's cool.
Yeah.
A little Hindu tribute yourself.
Yeah.
To send off your dad.
Didn't even know it. We're going back to familiar territory now. My favorite pastry of all time, Ruff Puff. Tell me about your Ruff Puff adventures.
Okay. So this was during COVID. It's all happened in reverse, I'd feel. During COVID, was watching, we got hooked on MasterChef. Hadn't watched MasterChef for like, probably since like season, I think Adam Liao won, and then maybe
season
I stopped.
Two.
Not just because of life and work and like gigs, and there's a zillion episodes a year. So if you miss the first few, you're like, oh, I can't be bothered.
Yeah, can't catch up.
Yeah,
no, I feel it.
Yeah. But COVID, it was like, this is the perfect show, really.
It was. That was the 2020 season, I think. Like back to win.
Back
so
to
was
win.
The new host.
Yes.
Yes. No, I remember it well. I was glued to it.
It was exciting with the new hosts, and I think they did such a great job right out the gate. And then because it was returning talent, there was like, I didn't know who a lot of these people were, but there was excitement. I knew Poe, that was enough. I was hooked just to follow Poe. A lot of it was her just staring at an oven and like stressing out. I remember very clearly. And then I kind of had a crush on Amelia as well. She was there. It was a great entertaining season.
Yes.
My girlfriend had a crush on Reynolds. So there was something for everyone in this season.
There really was.
And then I decided, just because I had time up my sleeve, to start making like cooking videos.
Yes.
And just a weird thing in my brain clicked where I was like, what if I parody MasterChef? This was pre-TikTok and Instagram and everything. You just have a green screen now. It just provides it for you. But back then,
I DIY'd
my green screen. I just bought like a green tablecloth from like Priceline. And then, I mean, not Priceline, whatever.
Spotlight.
Linkcraft.
Yeah,
Spotlight maybe. Yep. Spotlight.
The haberdashery center.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And then just like hooked it up on the wall and I stood in front of it. And then I kind of like photoshopped the background to look like I was being interviewed for MasterChef.
Yes.
And I would do the cooking videos. And then what happened was somehow someone from the production team at MasterChef saw it and hit me up and was like, hey, do you want to audition for MasterChef? We think you'd be fun on it. And so then, because it's COVID, it's like, this comedy is not a career anymore.
Yes.
I'm not going to perform on Zoom forever. This is horrible. So I thought, yeah, why not?
Wow.
And then I did a deep dive into trying to learn all of these different skills that I didn't have.
Yep.
Because I'd learnt over a few years through, particularly after I could start eating all this stuff again, like shellfish and peanuts or whatever. I remember the first thing when I could eat prawns, I was like, Mum's sambal prawn.
Yes, I watched that video.
That's all everyone talks about is sambal prawns. And whenever she made it. And so I was like, I've got to learn how to do this.
Yep.
And so that was like one of the first things I cooked. And then gradually became addicted to cooking, like, yeah, Malaysian, Sri Lankan stuff. Yep. But that's not enough to be on MasterChef. So I had to learn all these things. And the rough puff is one of the, it's like thinking about the staples or the pantry staples, yes, or whatever. What can I make if I've only got the flour and the milk and butter or whatever?
Yep.
And yeah, so I learned how to make a rough puff. I remember watching this. It's like Food 52.
Yes. Yes, I know that website.
Yeah. And yep, I can't remember her name. I wish I had looked it up, but I should have looked it up before coming here. But she has this extensive series on baking and pie crusts.
Oh, yes. Do you know what? I was looking at a recipe of hers just today.
Okay.
It's like Emily McSomething.
Yes. Yeah, Emily, yeah.
I have the, continue. Okay. I'm going to find it because it's going to shit us.
So I watched all of her videos and then I was like, it actually isn't, making a rough puff looks so fun.
Yeah, it is.
And I mean, it's not hard. Like one day I'll be brave enough to make an actual puff pastry, but I don't trust myself with all the measurements. That's the thing. I think all the physical stuff I think I could do.
Yeah.
But like getting the precision, I'm not very neat and I'm not very, I don't have great spatial awareness. So all the folding I think might go awry, but the rough puff of just cutting it up into cubes,
yeah,
as a shortcut. And I really loved how taking it from like a shaggy mess, not overworking it,
yes,
putting it in the fridge, and then you take it out like an hour later and it's like all one thing.
Hmm.
That blew my mind. Yeah. I didn't know. Yeah. As someone who wasn't like working with doughs a lot and that kind of thing, I was like, how is this happening?
There's some magic around rough puff. It's Erin McDowell.
That's it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Great series. If anyone wants to get into like pie crusts, it's so informative and she makes it very simple to follow.
She does. Look, you touched on full puff. There's no point. I made full puff once and it was on Bake Off and I lost that. I came second last in that challenge because he cuts it. It was for a beef Wellington. So just picture this beautifully cooked beef that we spent hours doing. And then there's this rough puff that we were rolling and folding. And then because I didn't do it right, it was all like raw at the bottom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like rough puff in the bin. I mean, no, full puff in the bin. Yeah. Keep the rough puff.
Yeah.
You get the same result.
I feel like it's one of those things where you just do it once to be like, I've done it. So now I'm justified in taking the shortcut. But maybe I'll never get to that point because the shortcut is so flaky. So many layers. Like it is, yeah. I reckon you'd fool a lot of people with a rough puff.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What did you make with your rough puff? So you've done the puff.
Yes.
What are you making with it?
I made a bunch of stuff, but the piece de resistance, I think, would be because it was 2020 is probably when that big lockdown is probably when I learned how to do the rough puff.
Yep.
But then in the next 2021, there was that other lockdown in Sydney.
So you're in Sydney Melbourne at the time.
Yeah, I was living in Sydney at the time. I think you was the same for people down here, but we had like the state mandated picnics.
Yeah.
It was like, that's all you could do was have a picnic.
I remember the picnic days.
Yeah.
They drew circles. I don't know if they did this in Sydney. You know, the line marking that they use for sports ovals.
Yeah.
They did circles in parks and that was where you could sit for your picnic.
They did not do that in Sydney. Oh. And it's giving a lot of context to why everyone in Melbourne is still like a little loose.
Get a little twitch.
Everyone's a bit loopy here. We didn't have the circles on the ground in Sydney. I mean, in fact, yeah, I do feel like because I'm from Melbourne and I was living in Sydney at the time, there was not much, I'll be honest, there was not a lot of empathy in Sydney for people in Melbourne.
Yes.
Because I knew so many people here, I was like, they're losing their goddamn minds. They are going through a lot. But we, in Sydney, we went along to one of these picnics in the park.
Yep.
And I think it was part of this thing of you haven't seen a whole lot of people. And so I felt very competitive. Well, I wanted to bring something that would like, you know, stand out. Yes. So I made like a onion, like tart kind of, is it tart tatin type thing?
Yes. So, or galette?
Yeah. It was open.
The one where you
folded over. Yes. Yeah. But it had like, but I did caramelize the onions in the way you would for a tartare. And I used like shallot. I used like three different types of onions and shallots and maybe even leeks, I think.
Ooh,
and
it was,
yeah. That's you needed whatever kind of validation you could get in this time, in this phase of our lives.
It's so true.
Yeah, and it was a beautiful picnic. I think someone else who I hadn't met before, which is so weird to be meeting new people and in this picnic scenario.
Yes.
Because you're like, you'd think you'd use the three people you get.
Yeah.
It's like you going to prison and using your one call on like a chat line or something. But she was an avid cook as well and baker, and she brought these little sausage rolls. She made them. They were really good. So it was a bit of a competition, I think. But yeah, I think
had she made her own pastry though?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm sure she would have.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty good. But yeah, it was so that picnic scenario, it's funny to think how much effort I went to actually. I reckon I don't think I've baked anything as impressive since.
That's what I was about to ask. Have you gone to that effort since?
I do like to make the galette like with just like fruit. And as I said, I'm not great with precision. And the galette, the beauty of the galette is you just plop it in the middle and fold it over. Yeah.
And if it dribbles out on the side, it just makes it look better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's like people are going to cut it up and eat it anyway.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, yeah, it looks good for a minute and then it gets destroyed.
Here, yeah.
I'm just skipping a step.
Yeah. I love it. We're going to continue the deep philosophical discussion now for your final course, which comes in two helpings. Your first serve comes in the form of a question sent from a fellow bakeologist. Now, the original question from Michael here in Melbourne, hello, Michael, is what is your ultimate savoury bake? Now, I feel like you might have just answered that with your onion galette, but...
Okay, I will just to say something different because the onion galette was very good, but I discovered this thing. I have a friend, his name's Ivan Aristigueta. He's a very funny comedian and a very talented cook.
Yes, he was a guest in season one.
Oh, well, there you go. Yes. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
He's a great, so funny, but also he knows food so intimately.
Yeah, food scientist, I believe.
Yes,
yeah.
And one thing I love about him is he doesn't mind thinking outside the square and trying to improvise and trying to like take different things and smash them together. And he had this idea of, because in Adelaide they have the 24-hour bakeries, and he's, when I was talking about migration to regional cities or regional towns, he's one of the guys that I think of first because he came from Venezuela and picked Adelaide as his destination. And so he started his career in comedy in Australia, in Adelaide. Mm. But they have these 24-hour bakeries and they have the pie floaters there.
Yes.
Which is like their mushy peas on top with gravy, and then you cut into the pie and it all sort of falls in. And he was like, why don't we do that with dal and like curry sauce? And so he basically, one of the videos he made during COVID was like he had this idea. He was making all of these new inventions. He did this series and he was like, let's do a dal pie floater.
Pie floater.
And so I taught him how to make dal.
Yeah.
And then he made the pie. I think he probably bought a pie, but he's
lazy bugger.
Yeah. Yeah. But so I think to me the ultimate savoury pastry bake is, because I've made it at home, I made it with a pumpkin curry
inside the pie.
Oof. And then dal on top and like gravy on the top of that.
Yeah.
And it's like, I mean, it makes so much sense because flaky buttery pastry is like rotty really.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So it tastes insane. It's great.
What a great answer. that's so good.
If I'd known that, I would have taken that to the picnic. I guess.
Hindsight.
Yeah.
Hindsight. All right. Your second serve. It's time for Whiskey Business, the game that is positively overflowing with tough choices and difficult questions. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. In the battle of the classic takeaway foods, do you choose pizza, fish and chips, or a curry from an origin of your choice?
Wow. I am on the record as saying I'm not a huge pizza guy. So that's an easy knockout.
Mm.
Fish and chips, a good fish and chips is pretty, it knocks you away sometimes.
Mm.
But curry from a choice of my own.
Yes, you choose.
Yeah. I feel like it's going to be a boring answer, but I'm going to go with the curry because
that's not boring at all.
Well, I think it's boring for me because it's like I eat so much curry, but I think I have had, there's like curries in my life that I've had where I'm like, this is, like I'm picturing a rendang at the moment. And I'm like, does that count as a curry? That's a curry. I'm saying it's a curry.
Yeah. So I'm going to take your advice on that.
I taste a rendang and I'm like, it's one of those things where I'm like, yeah, that's a gift from God kind of thing. You know, you taste it and you're like, oh my God, this is, yeah. I don't think any of us came up with this. This is too good. This was like, maybe like the Egyptian, some pyramids and lizard people came and they passed this on. It's just like, yeah, heavenly kind of thing.
This is what they meant when they created those foods. They wanted these to come together this particular way.
Yeah.
All right. This next one's actually inspired by Ivan.
Oh yeah.
I didn't know there was going to be a link there. That's really nice.
That's nice.
Is custard just cold sweet soup?
I often think about how when you get soft serve ice cream, or when like you let sometimes you know it's nice to like whip the ice cream yourself and it
melts.
At
the end.
Yeah. And then it is like you're just drinking sweet cream at that point. It's no longer ice cream. It's sort of, and it is like it is just back to its custard form.
Yes.
So I'm going to say yes. And I'm going to say yes, but don't let that disparage you from consuming it in that way, because it's delicious.
It should enhance the experience.
It does.
Would have thought.
Yeah.
You have a craving for some bowl food. Do you choose ramen or pho or pho, depending on?
Okay, I'm gonna go pho because ramen, it's tricky to order with a sesame allergy. Because you have to. It's always in the base.
Yes.
And so, like, there's maybe one or two ramens they're never the ones that people really love, like the Tun Tun ramen or whatever. All of that's sesame. So pho is usually pretty safe. As I get older, I'm inclining more towards veg. And luckily, being from Sri Lankan background, it's like probably one of the best cuisines, I think, if you are veg. Because there's so many different vegetables and so much flavor. You can have like, just picture that banana leaf thing. Probably the majority of it was veg around that feast. So I'll say veg.
Yeah, good choice. Good choice. And finally, you're planning your perfect high tea, three dishes, three guests. What are you serving and who's coming, alive, dead or fictional?
Okay, great. Well, first guest is going to be Anthony Bourdain.
Oh.
I think.
Mm.
The alive version.
Yeah, okay, good. Not just the dead body in the corner.
Yeah.
Good to clarify.
And not like the digital AI version that they used in the documentary or whatever. I think... when we were making Good Tucker, there's no denying that his show was like a inspiration for me in trying to do that. And his book's like such a great read. And just I wish I had the eloquence that he does in the way that he narrates his way through, the show and the book and his life in general. Yeah. Such a interesting, complex, but I think he's so charismatic as well. I think he would be so entertaining. I don't know. Do you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I've seen bits and pieces. Yeah. I haven't watched.
There is that one joke from that show is how Larry, he observes that at a dinner party, you have to have someone who's a good middler.
Yeah.
Which means the person in the middle that can captain the conversation. And if you put the wrong person in the middle of the table, the whole thing goes wrong.
Yeah.
And I feel like Bourdain is king of the middle.
Love it.
He's gonna keep it going, keep the ball in the air. He'll probably make fun of you if you say the wrong, but in a fun way that'll be inclusive. But I think he's
gonna grease that conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. That's as far as I've thought. I reckon then we'll probably Shane Warne. I love cricket.
Yes.
I didn't mean to pick two people who've passed away and so recently as well. But I think Shane Warne, again, he seems like the quintessential fun larrikin Aussie kind of guy. And I think we live in a very complex society now where that we've started to recognise that there's more to Australia than just the like larrikin.
Yeah.
But as part of that, I think we've also forgotten a bit how fun that part of our identity was.
Yeah.
As long as it's not like racist and bigoted and homophobic or whatever. But like, I don't think Shane Warne was a lot of that. I think he was like pretty fun loving guy, but also quite accepting and inclusive. So hopefully, that's two guys that'll get along as well, I think,
with each other. Yeah.
And then the third it's so hard to limit it from all of people.
And people who don't actually exist.
That's true as well. I think maybe I'm gonna say Padma Lakshmi. I don't know who that is. She's like a American food. She used to be the host on Top Chef.
Ah.
Which was the American's Master Chef kind of thing.
Yep.
And she is absolutely gorgeous, but also like loves food and very, and I think it'll be a, she's like a fun person to, as someone who wants to make TV that's food oriented, I feel like her and Bourdain would be good people to pick their ears. The food.
Yes.
Even though I said veg, I'm going to start with fried chicken.
Great. Wow.
Because I think fried chicken is almost in the same way that I was like, rendang is this thing where it's like, we didn't come up with this. This was gifted to us. Mm-hmm. Fried chicken is, it's always serves its purpose.
Yeah.
You know, when you're craving fried chicken and you have it and it's like, you're like, that's exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
No regrets. Sometimes you're craving something and you have it and you're like, ah,
yeah,
I'm a bad person.
Yeah.
Fried chicken is never.
I need to shower.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So start with fried chicken. I think then I'm going to say, I don't even know if these don't all go together, but I think I'm then going to say laksa.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is a crazy high tea.
No, I love it.
But
I'm picturing it in little bowls. Yes. Fantastic.
Yeah. Again, because I just love anything coconut and spicy.
Yeah.
And then since we've done that and we want to finish on something sweet and probably gentle, maybe I'll go the treacle with the curd.
Do you know that? I'm so glad you went there.
Yeah.
What a lovely way to round out the episode.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Soren, thank you so much for being on
Bakeology. Thanks for having me. It was a real, real joy.
It's been so much fun. Do you know what I have in my bag? I don't know if we can actually, we probably can't eat it, but these are cookies with the recipe from your crush from MasterChef.
Really?
Believe it or not.
No way.
Emilia Jackson's cookies.
Amazing.
So we can go and enjoy these.
Oh, yes. Very special. Thank you.
No, thank you.
What a way to bring the season to a close. You can follow Soren on Instagram at Soren Comedy and check out his website for all his upcoming tour dates. And make sure that you check out Good Tucker on SBS On Demand. I was inspired by our chat about the gloriously named pie floater. So I grabbed a pie from the Paran Market and whipped up my favourite dal recipe so I could experience this taste sensation for myself. So jump onto Instagram to check out my favourite dal recipe as I road test this delicious delicacy. And don't forget, if you enjoyed Bakeology, please leave a rating and a review. It really helps independent podcasts like mine get noticed. And as I said last week, it really means a lot to me as well. And so here we are at the end of season 2 of Bakeology. 8 weeks really does fly by. If you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening along. Making Bakeology is a real joy, and I hope that you get as much out of listening as I do making it. Everyone has a story to tell, and exploring our lives through food uncovers truly magical memories that helps us understand who we are. We had quite a few of those moments this season, and it's these exact moments that I think make Bakeology truly special. And I hope that by listening, you discover some things about yourself along the way. I'd love to know what you thought about this season, so do send me a message on Instagram or via my email. I welcome all your feedback and ideas, and it'll help me make season 3 even better when it returns towards the end of the year. Thank you once again for joining me on this delicious journey. It really does mean the world. And until we meet again, stay sweet and watch out for those soggy bottoms.
Comes in the form of Whiskey Business, a game that, like a forgotten bath. No, I fucked that up. Let me start that again. I'm just going to skip that pun because it's going to be too hard.
Okay.